for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Discussing national and international issues, you're listening to Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon, 2 days before the Easter weekend. We've got this packed two-hour program where we bring the brightest, most interesting guests from around the world to your attention. Our first guest is Paul Gottfried, a brilliant writer and academic who could be called a kind of father figure of the whole alt-right movement, sometimes called the paleo-conservative movement, which rejected the neocon idea of invade the world, invite the world. I remember reading his book, The Strange Death of Marxism, a couple of years ago, and it was an absolute blowout, which changed the world way I looked at everything, basically, about world politics. So I'm very happy to be able to talk to him. It'll be interesting to see whether he regards Trump in some way as being in the paleoconservative ballpark, and if he's been inspired by what Gottfried's been writing. Our next guest is after that is Richard Cook, who's described as the greatest whistleblower in modern American history for exposing the true causes of the Challenger disaster. If you remember the space shuttle that blew up in 1986, he's here to talk about that and perhaps intriguingly whether Biden's America is metaphorically heading for, as it were, something similar, an explosion in space. After the hour, our first guest is Simon Roche, or Roche, spokesman for the Zuidlanders of South Africa, the world's largest independent civil defense organization, where Dutch or Afrikaans speakers in South Africa gather to preserve their identity and perhaps, in the case of a civil war or something, gather together and unite. The question is, with the population replacement happening in Europe, whether we will have to face similar problems 20 or 30 or 40 years down the line. We've got a very interesting guest for you today, so just stick around for today's talk. But first, I want to talk about something that is a little bit of a change from my usual doom and gloom news, which is the publication of the World Happiness Index, which has just been published. Which country is happiest? Well, it's the Scandinavian countries that take the top four positions. And the country with the flag behind me, where I'm located right now, Sweden, is actually at number four, which would surprise a lot of people who think there is a civil war going on with gang warfare and mass rape. Well, you certainly don't see that. It's a complicated picture. I think that the Swedish rape rate is higher than it used to be. And it is true that a majority of the rapes are carried out by non-native Swedes. But it's also true that the definition of rape in Sweden is quite generous because of the strong feminist movement that wants to define a lot of things as rape. So the actual statistics don't tell the true story. And it's interesting because it means, well, if this, it's also true that Sweden's, to a greater extent, even than the other Scandinavian countries, is seeing a very rapid demographic change. So if you just have to look at any kindergarten or primary schoolyard to see that there's a very large non-white, non-native population. So this survey was conducted in 2023. Does that mean that the large migrant population hasn't affected Sweden's well-being? Well, it could be. I mean, although it's also true that the arrivals come from some of the countries which have the lowest human happiness index in the world and lowest quality of life index, countries like Afghanistan and sub-Saharan Africa. So does that mean that the benign Swedish welfare state has integrated people into happiness? Well, maybe. It could also be a sampling mistake. We know that during the PISA studies, which is a sort of worldwide academic studies test, where Sweden comes out better than it did a couple of years ago after a terrible collapse of its results. But it was then discovered by a local Swedish newspaper that there'd been a sampling mistake, so deliberate or not, I don't know, that excluded some of the sink schools, some of the bad schools where there's a large recent migrant population arrived. Of course, in Britain and other places, non-whites, Indians and Africans even, I think, have better results than the natives. But anyway, in Sweden, the new arrivals have terrible results. And if they'd been included, they would have brought the PISA results down. So have this happiness index excluded some of the migrants or those who live next to migrants from this happiness index? I don't know. It's interesting. Certainly, There are a lot of good things about Scandinavian Sweden. Iceland, Norway, and Finland make up the other four in the world's happiest countries, and it's worth Americans looking at it. I mean, Swedes have high taxes, but there is a lot of personal freedom. There's a lot of emptiness that could work both ways. You don't feel in Sweden that you're sort of crowded in by large groups of people. I think Britain is suffering from a very, very high population density at the moment. Sweden does feel physically open. At the same time as it's open, there's a very good infrastructure, packed supermarkets, I mean, very food from all over the world. But at the same time, Swedes are quite socially conformist and don't make friends easily. It's shyness or coldness or whatever. And there are those long winters and winter darkness. So it works, you know. It's worth looking, because happiness is one of the most important things that we should be looking at for the next 20 or 30 years. I really do believe that. There's a positive psychology movement that talks about we should forget about schizophrenia and those things that affect, or transgender neuroticism, which affects a very small number of people, and focus on basic things like what makes normal people happy. And we'll be interviewing positive psychologists on this program to bring this to our attention in the same way that I've talked to longevity experts. Finally, a note on what's happening in the UK and the US on this survey. Germany and France don't do particularly well. The big countries tend not to do so. But the US has fallen 8 places since last year. And that's particularly true where young people under 30 are very, very unhappy in the UK, in the US, sorry. And they're only in the 62nd place as far as the world happiness goes. And that's really low compared to the older population of the US. So we've got a young cohort there in the US, which are very worried about jobs. They're very worried about their status, very worried about their identity, very worried about finding housing. They're living with their parents. UK is suffering from the same problems. Anyway, we are going to, as I said, talk about these issues more with guests in the upcoming weeks. But for the moment, we're just going to pivot over to Basil, our political editor, after a quick break for today's hottest news. This is Pelle Nereth Taylor on TNT's News Talk.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the show. Welcome to the show, Basil. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Pelle, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. I was listening to what you were saying about Sweden there earlier and the huge demographic change underway. People sometimes make the rather derogatory comment, you know, import the third world and you become the third world, referring to populations that are perhaps not well versed in the ways of Western European countries and the mores of behavior and all the rest of it that we've taken for granted for decades. I want to pivot over to the Western Hemisphere, because there are certainly two sides to this coin, and the dreadful situation in Haiti, which has come about largely as a result of a sort of failed imperial project lasting centuries. But then again, it could hardly be said that the people of Haiti have helped themselves. Who can forget the Clinton Foundation's promise to build houses following the earthquake that, translated into about 6 dwellings at, you know, millions each, because all the money disappeared. Now Haiti is gripped by a vortex of violence and poverty. Starving families are taking shelter from Haiti's capital battlefield. The whole of Port-au-Prince has become a sort of a no-go zone, really. Rubble strewn and broken roads, armed gangs fighting each other and the police, food shortages, burnt out and destroyed businesses. It's collapsed into a totally failed state. And people are saying that the United States might go in and occupy militarily in order to try and restore law and order following the resignation of the most recent prime minister. There being now a complete leadership void.
Well, I don't know. What do you think? I'm really anti-interventionist, but I mean, maybe in some cases it could be a good thing, especially as it's not contested. I thought about Haiti for a bit, because it's a sort of because I talked about it because the Clintons adopted Haiti as their favorite country a couple of when they were young, because they had their honeymoon in Haiti. And when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she put a lot of attention on Haiti. And I guess there's a kind of democratic favoritism because of the revolutionary history of Haiti. You know, it was the first for blacks. You know, it compares favorably to the United States as a constitutional revolutionary state in 1804, I think it was. And it's never lived up to that promise of a black democracy, you know. What they call it, that Wakanda myth, you know, that when blacks left to themselves, they'll rule themselves under completely democratic conditions. And then, of course, the French came and took back that Haiti, that democratic Haiti. And so Napoleon Bonaparte, a dictator in Europe, was also reimposed his dictatorship over Haiti. But I don't have any very strong views either way on intervention on that issue. What are the smoke signals in Washington?
Good question. I mean, the country is still reeling from the still unsolved assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. Then the caretaker prime minister backed by the international community, Ariel Henry, he proved unable to govern and unwilling to hold elections, a pretty bad combination for any leader. Tens of thousands of Haitians then voted with their feet, emigrating to the United States or elsewhere in Latin America, and the country's institutions have largely ceased to function. No democratically elected representatives remain, with drug traffickers and arms dealers profiting now from the chaos and the country being flooded with American-made weapons. Could it get any worse? You know, you know, occupation in this case might not be such a bad idea so long as it's temporary, but it seems like, well, I mean, I know every previous attempt at nation building, you know, particularly Iraq, obviously the Middle East, that was all done for all the wrong reasons, as we know. Perhaps because Haiti is on America's doorstep, there's therefore slightly some, you know, greater regional cultural understanding of the situation more than there is in the Middle East. I don't know. I mean, obviously, one doesn't really trust the Americans to do any good anywhere. But well, go on.
I've sort of worked out. I mean, when I was in my going through an EU critical phase, a mother of one of my friends said, "Well, you know, it gives them something to do, you know." So the political class flocked down. I mean, there was a very trendy meme in Sweden where my mother lived at the, well, she still lives there, but, you know, where all the macho Swedish men in their 40s and 50s would fly down to Brussels for the week. And that was such a cool thing. It attracted all the women, you know, you get away from the provincial Sweden. And you think, well, whether it's effective or not, it soaks up the excess energy of the European elite to sort of butt heads over widget sizes or whatever. And I sometimes went, well, maybe if Haiti becomes a focus for American do-goodism, you know, it saves the rest of us. If they can have 100 New York Times articles a day about Haiti's problems, you know, that's good for the rest of us because it absorbs American crusading energy somehow and it gives them something to do, basically. And they could kind of lick their wounds if they're withdrawing from the Middle East and losing in Ukraine or their proxy war. Then a victory in Haiti can be a you know, or some kind of nation building, and it'll absorb the progressive left, you know, the Black Lives Matter crowd. So
yeah, I mean, there have been four failed foreign interventions in Haiti over the last 30 years, two by the United States and two by the United Nations, meaning governments are reluctant to risk their reputations and their energies and their resources in something that's likely to become just a quagmire, with Latin American governments in particular reluctant to get involved. There is a glimmer of hope. The US and the Caribbean grouping CARICOM have sealed an agreement from Ariel Henry to cede power to a 7-member transitional council drawn from politics, civil society, and business. And that council would then appoint an interim government with a mandate to hold elections as soon as practicable. But, you know, frankly, on the ground at the moment, that doesn't do much for the thousands of starving and near starving people, and it doesn't do anything to sort of restore something like order to civil society, because it's sort of it's degenerated into sort of gun-toting, warring drug factions. I mean, the most sort of abysmal scenario you can imagine.
The leader of one of the factions is apparently called Barbecue, and I don't know, there's a Twitter photograph him eating what looked like a human officer. Leg. It's not verified. It could be fake.
Yeah, well, he's a former police officer called Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier. And he has exploited basically Haitians' revulsion at their political elite, who are, you know, ever since the days of, can you remember Papa Doc Duvalier and then Baby Doc? Haiti has always been plagued by this sort of extremely wealthy crust on the top of society, who don't give a damn about the starving peasants. And that's still the case to this day. There are still very wealthy individuals living up in the hills in their security compounds who are sort of completely unaffected by what's happening on the streets of Port-au-Prince.
I'm semi-curious to go to Haiti, actually, because we're going to keep you on for a couple of minutes because the next guest is kind of logging on. But I don't know if you saw that film, The Comedians, based on the Graham Greene novel with Elizabeth Taylor and Burton. And he had the Tonton Macoute, you know. These guys, they looked like they had these pork pie hats, and they're incredibly cool with their sunglasses. And they're driving these American cars from the 1960s. But they were vicious, you know. They'd drive up and kidnap people and kill them.
That's
right. And Macoute apparently is the name of a ghost or something in Haitian myth, where this ghost comes and seizes people from their homes and kills them. So the Tonton Macoute means uncle ghost or something. But I can't remember much of the plot, but this idea of Baby Doc and Papa Doc, just those names are incredibly evocative.
Yes, they are. But the Tonton Macoute were no joke. I mean, they were death squads. And, you know, the death squads are effectively back in the shape of these various gangs who, I mean, you know, this is sort of symptomatic of what's happened across Central America, really. You know, who can forget the Mexican drug wars? People aren't aware, Pelle. 60,000 or 70,000 people have been murdered in the Mexican drug wars over the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, these are incredible numbers, you know. Large parts of Mexico are effectively ruled by the cartels, and you know, it's only really sort of Costa Rica and to a lesser extent El Salvador now, where, the power of the gangs is limited, whether it's people trafficking, kidnapping, arms dealing, extortion, you know, it's the full range of horrors. So if you want to go to Haiti, Pelle, you're taking your life in your hands.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the American presenters talk a lot and worry a lot about the American southern border. And of course, that's a much more interesting and acute topic for them than, interventions in Ukraine. Of course it should be, and it is, and it should be. But it's interesting you're saying about Mexico, because I think a lot of Europeans have this idea that Mexico is an upper middle income country, which works basically, you know, because of NAFTA. And but with those death tolls, it is basically a civil war. A lot of the countries with the highest murder rates are in Latin America. You know, I mean, the top five, I think, El Salvador, Venezuela, maybe even Mexico. So Haiti's got competition there. But what I was going to say, I forgot what I was going to say about Latin America. But I mean, of course, America still has this informal Monroe Doctrine, which says that no outside power can meddle in the world island, or whatever you call it, the Americas. So there is a residual sense of responsibility there for Haiti, but it must feel like it was one of can we swear on this program? It's what one of Trump's shithole countries, wasn't it? And then he got a lot of pushback from that. But you know, are there any of the analyses you've read had any end game for this? I mean, what to do about Haiti?
Well, this joint US CARICOM plan is the only one on the table. It's rejected by the gangs, who just want to extend their own power. So, you know, we really need to sort of hit the reset button with Haiti. Ideally, one would want to be able to turn it off and turn it on again, you know. There are no quick fixes, really. It's as simple as that. The international security force should really be beefed up. You've got to get some sort of, you know, blue helmet troops on the ground to at least restore law and order. That's kind of the, you know, 101 in Haiti at the moment before you can start talking about rebuilding infrastructure or anything. The power of the gangs has got to be broken. That's the, that would be number one, really.
Well, I'm glad. Anyway, Basil, I'm glad you talked about Haiti because we don't talk about those countries too often. And it's very important that we discuss issues like that. But we'll have you back in the next hour to talk about more up-to-date news. We're going to our break and our first guest of the day. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT News Talk. Back in a few seconds.
TNT's Mark Morano.
And there's a whole history of this idea that the establishment, the powers that be, the regime in power, likes the idea of a little eco-terrorism to keep the population hungry. I mean, if you think about it, their policies, government policies of the Great Reset, Net Zero, Climate Agenda, are quite literally eco-terrorism or a form of terrorism. It's, as Jesse Jackson used to say, it's economic violence, it's economic terrorism. Jesse Jackson used to say that about the Reagan administration. But in this case, it's the intentional collapse of energy, food, transportation, free speech, all to achieve and make us safer and give them more power under the auspices, if you will, of a crisis.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon. So, what are the intellectual origins of the MAGA movement and Trump? Here to discuss this is the esteemed Professor Paul Gottfried, a historian, writer, and former professor of humanities, the Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He's editor-in-chief of the paleoconservative magazine Chronicles. Now, he is a great intellectual hero of mine. I'm very glad we could have him on, because when I read one of his books about the development of Marxism in Europe and how it's changed after the Cold War, everything began to make sense, because I lived through the Cold War and I lived through the period after, and the left became a completely different movement. It became a movement that protected the white working class to one that excoriated the white working class, one that was in favor of trade unions and closed borders to one that was in favor of open borders, one that put the white working class on the pedestal to one that put refugees and immigrants from non-European countries on a pedestal. So basically, Paul's book, which he wrote in 2002, explained this very, very well. And he's written a lot of other things about how the demonization of the working class has become a kind of go-to view of left-wing movements, perhaps even in the United States. So, Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show. Tell us about what you, if your thoughts have developed since that book you wrote in 2002 about the strange death of European Marxism.
You know, I actually, my thoughts have developed in the same direction in which that one finds in that book. I mean, I am convinced that the change is by now irreversible, that there is a right-left polarization in the United States, but it is one in which the working class here and in Europe finds itself on the right. And verbalizing elites, academics, the administrative state, all find themselves on the left. The reaction against somebody like Trump seems to me, at least in part, and I mean, if one ignores or disregards his verbal hyperbole, it seems to me to be very much directed against the working class, the working class here, and as I said, and throughout Western Europe, less so perhaps in Germany than in England, in France, Italy, are now very much allied to a right, and the whole Cold War paradigm of Marxism and anti-Marxism has become entirely irrelevant. If people think I've converted to communism. No, I've not converted to communism or Marxism. I just don't think that the enemy that we traditionalists are facing today has anything to do with Marxism. As a matter of fact, you find corporate capitalism is now part of the leftist coalition, and the working class is part of the rightist coalition.
It's very strange, isn't it? Because you've got what I traditionally regard as social democracy, European social democracy, which I'm very familiar with, which is, let's have peace, and let's peace and bread. That was those classic socialist slogans, peace and bread, which means, and you look after your people, as it were, without being aggressive to the others. So in Sweden, where I've lived some of my life, Olof Palme, for instance, he would be regarded as a far right winger today. So although he was very pro ANC in Southern Africa and very pro anti-Vietnam War, peace campaigner and known as almost a communist to American neocons in the 1980s, he actually said, we can't let in non-whites to Sweden because, they won't fit in and Sweden will lose its cohesion and its willingness to pay taxes. And that willingness to pay high taxes is a tribal thing. Swedes want to pay taxes for other Swedes. And now, of course, the Swedish corporate class who want to lower taxes, they brought in these immigrants partly because they knew that it'll break up the tax solidarity among the working class. Anyway, so Palme, this hero of the Swedish left, still would be regarded as a far right winger according to the rules today because he's expressed dislike for kind of mass immigration. And then, of course, it's peace. The far right in Europe, AfD and so on, don't want war with Russia. They want peace with Russia, whereas it's the leftists. They worry about what is it they worry about what transgender issues, but they don't worry about nuclear war. I mean, that's strange, isn't it? And it completely, and you predicted all that.
Yeah, it's
20
it's
years
strange,
ago.
But there are things that sort of confuse or muddy the picture, and I think those are important things to look at. The left still considers itself in some sense to be Marxist. And in many ways, as I argue in my book on anti-fascism, which came out with Cornell about 2 years ago, people like Jason Stanley in the United States who are into anti-fascism at the same time support very, they express great sympathy for Marxist regimes that were hardly feminist and treated homosexuals horribly. But they do see solidarity with the historic left, even though they have very little in common with it. But they see themselves as part of a sort of a seamless leftist tradition. Meanwhile, the right still fights the ghost of communism. Every time they talk about China, which is an unpleasant authoritarian nationalist regime, it's communism. It's sort of going back to the war against communism. Because the American conservative establishment feels comfortable with the communist enemy, which it fought for about 50 years. So the enemy remains communism. There is an absolutely horrible book by Mark Levin, who is a conservative establishment celebrity, called American Marxism. I looked at it. I didn't find too many examples of Marxism in the book. I mean, John Dewey was not a Marxist. Other people he cites were not Marxist. Progressives were not Marxist. But again, it's the attempt to tap into this Cold War mentality, which is directed at fighting communism. Although the enemy they face today is, to some extent, a corporate capitalist enemy on the left.
So, what you're saying is, I mean, Trump draws a lot of his supporters from the neglected white working class, you know, who used to vote Democrat, and his equivalents in Europe, which exist, also do the same. But yet they've kept some aspects of the right wing, which is the communist bogeyman, Chinese bogeyman in this case, and maybe to some extent the Russian one, because they seem to think Putin is a communist, you know, even though Putin said in an interview 2 weeks ago, we're bourgeois like you. Why do you hate us? You know?
Yes.
But and why has well, we've got to go into a quick break, but we'll talk after the break. We'll talk about why the business corporate class and have turned so much into leftist tropes. We've got Paul Gottfried with us, who's kind of the godfather of a lot of the philosophies that underpin MAGA, I think. We'll be back after a quick news break. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
TNT Radio News.
Get the news. The news.
Matt Boylant here with a look at your TNT headlines. Six people are presumed dead following the bridge collapse in Baltimore, with authorities confirming they will start searching for their bodies on Wednesday morning. The US has 3 weeks to prove to London's High Court that Julian Assange will be spared the death penalty and will be protected by the First Amendment if he is extradited on espionage charges. And Australia looks set to become the first country in the world to launch a formal investigation into the alarming rise in excess deaths.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We've got Paul Gottfried with us, who is perhaps the founder of the paleoconservative movement, which is a sort of softer version of conservatism than the neocons, and is hugely influential, I think, behind a lot of the ideas that inform Trump and the MAGA movement. So, Paul, why is the corporate movement, if the working class, as it were, shifted to the right and then start voting for people like Trump, why has the corporate class moved to the left?
Yeah, I think there are several reasons for this, some of which I go into my book on anti-fascism. I think, is sociological. The people who are on corporate boards today are culturally and socially very different, you know, from the people you would have found there 100 years ago or 70 years ago, who were mostly of Northern European Protestant descent. And generally tried to keep other people off these boards, like Eastern European Jews, like people from the Far East, more recently of people from India who have come. Mm. And their culture is different. They still view themselves as outsiders. So that their relationship to what they see as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment, which, by the way, has not existed in America for a very, very long time. But their relationship to this, what they see as a kind of dominant hegemonic force that impinges on their life, I think drives them culturally and socially to the left. Another point that I think it has to be kept in mind is many of these people went to Ivy League universities. They went to elite schools where they were indoctrinated in woke ideology. If they weren't, then their wives are. So the women are usually more radical than the men. Finally, I would say that there is this sort of globalist imperative or impulse in corporate capitalism. I mean, they do not see national borders. It's the kind of thing Christopher Lash discussed in Revolt of the Elites. They have no national loyalty. They have no sense of community, really. They gravitate toward universalism, universalist ideas. They also are very happy to have women working. They produce more. If they have to stay home and have kids, they're not as economically valuable. Finally, another explanation that I've arrived at is that politically we've been going to the left for a very long time, but it was for a long time, a kind of socialist or social democratic left toward which we are moving, and not one that really would please these people, these corporate executives. So that if we were going to become more egalitarian, it would not be economically egalitarian. We'd become egalitarian in some cultural sense, which would not affect their fortunes very much.
Right.
There are some attempts made by these leftist governments, like Biden's government, or today's leftist government, to raise corporate taxes. Needless to say, their crony capitalist friends are not going to pay them. They're going to be passed along to the working class or to the consumer. They will pay for the additional money, which will then go to the government, and then these people continue to receive favors in terms of green energy projects and other things, other favors the government can give out. So the crony capitalist arrangement is quite compatible with the imposition of woke ideology.
Don't you also think maybe, I mean, let's all this obsessive focus on sexuality and transgender identity, I mean, for a start, it demonizes, you know, the family-oriented working class. And then secondly, it drives all our collective political attention on these things which are essentially not harmful to the corporate class, you know, whereas their big threat, and I used to think, well, nationalism is a right-wing thing and unionism, joining trade unionism, is a left-wing thing, but they're actually on the same side of the spectrum because they're an organization of the white working class, both nationalism and unionization, which of course was, in fact, she was a nationalist, but she was anti-union, for example, but actually they're protection units for the white working class, you could say, and that's economic power that they could muster up, or economic threat is a real threat to the corporations. So the corporations turning this woke thing into a sort of pseudo issue which divides the left wing elite, the university elite, because they're pro transgender, from their wards, as it were, the right wing, now right wing working class, and so they're not meeting in the middle anymore. They can't find a common cause, and then it allows the working class with their family and kids to be held up as really bad guys rather than the good guys.
Yeah, but if you notice, the Democratic Party in the United States is in favor of compulsory unionization for one obvious reason, because they will give money to the Democratic Party once the unionization takes place.
Right.
So it's a matter of feathering their own bed.
Right. Okay, so that's a complicating factor. Okay. Because I was just thinking, well, I was never in favor of unions, but I could sort of see that they provide some kind of collective bargaining power, which has been hollowed out in Europe anyway, you know, I mean, the unions since Thatcher. So Thatcher was actually probably a liberal. I mean, she was a revolutionary in a way, even though she's held up as a conservative icon. Anyways, Paul Gottfried, we've got to wind up there. I'm very sorry we can't talk about your recent books, but where can we find you? What's your most recent book is about fascism, fighting?
Yeah, it's called Anti-Fascism. I wrote Anti-Fascism. A book on fascism, which did very well. And the sequel to that was a book on anti-fascism, which had done well, but not quite as well as the book on fascism.
Right.
And some of the ideas that you find in my work on the post-Marxist left reappear in the study of anti-fascism. I think anti-fascism is very important, you know, as a unifying ideology for the left.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I mean, we'd love to have you on again, maybe to discuss that. We didn't get further because that was my heroic book, as it were, hero book, the earlier one. So, and I haven't read your anti-fascism or your fascism book, but I'll do so. And maybe we could have you on again. Okay. Paul Gottfried, historian and professor of humanities and paleoconservative extraordinaire. Thank you very much for appearing on our show. Thank you. Right. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor show on TND's New Talk. And we're going on into a quick break before our next guest.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear, but don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Pre-retirement? Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Potential tax breaks?
Yep. Boo.
I could build up savings for my side hustle. This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Are you ready to help your family get prepared for the unexpected?
Here we go!
Ladybug and Cat Noir know how important it is to be ready, because you never know when Hawk Moth is going to strike or a disaster will hit. And you don't need miraculous powers. Just put those planning skills you already have to good use. Make a plan that will help you and your family be ready when emergencies happen. Ready Kids can help. Get started at ready.gov/kids.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon on TNT News Talk. If our last guest was one of the top thinkers of the conservative movement, our next guest is one of the top whistleblowers in modern American history. His name is Richard Cook, and exposed the true causes of the Challenger disaster. If you remember, it was the space shuttle that blew up in 1986. It was one of the great disasters of the space age, and he was in government positions then, which allowed him to leak information that was very detrimental to the official story. And I think that when Richard speaks up, you'd better listen, because he's got another story for you, and he's got warnings for where America's heading now. Now retired, he spent his career in the federal government, including the U.S. Civil Service Commission, the FDA, the Carter White House, NASA, and the U.S. Treasury. He's written a number of books and has been highly critical of the current financial system, detailing his concerns in We Hold These Truths, The Hope of Monetary Reforms. His latest book is Our Country Then and Now, where he talks about America and how it's lost touch with its founding principles. He also thinks the Biden government or Biden administration is in deep trouble. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So just, I know you've told this story a million times, but it's always good to have a new generation. You wrote your Challenger Revealed book, which was your insider's account of how the Reagan administration caused the greatest tragedy of the space age. What consisted your whistleblowing, and how did that change the narrative and the story?
I was working as an analyst in the space shuttle program. And one of my assignments was to interview the solid rocket booster engineers. They gave me the inside story that there was an extreme danger of the failure of the shuttle due to flaws in the design of the solid rocket boosters, and that on any given launch, the shuttle could explode. NASA management had refused to stop flying because they thought they could fix it in time to prevent a disaster. And there were many reasons why they refused to do this. But the Challenger blew up that cold January morning. And we knew, I knew, and I had all the documentation to prove it, exactly what had happened. NASA began a cover-up, and they were joined in that cover-up by a presidential commission appointed by the White House. And they had no intention of disclosing what had happened. So after making some inquiries, in terms of, you know, can I give you some documents, and was told to shut up, I took these documents to the New York Times Bureau in Washington, D.C., and said, here. And they printed those documents the next Sunday, and that blew the whole story open. Now, within a week of that, the engineers from Sciacol, who made the solid rocket boosters, came forward and said, yeah, we pleaded with NASA not to launch that night because it was so cold. And so gradually the whole story came out. But what they didn't ever report on was how the Reagan White House had pressured NASA to launch, because they wanted to have the space shuttle in orbit for President Reagan's State of the Union address that night. That was really pushed them over the ledge.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, because, I mean, the Reagan, he's very controversial in his time, but myself included now, you know, tend to sort of idolize him as an optimistic guy who ran the U.S. and was an optimistic, and we all liked him. But this is a kind of critique of the Reagan administration we don't often hear. And what was the fallout from this? How did NASA solve the problem? And did you get into sort of political trouble for it? I mean, in your career, was it affected in any way?
After I testified to the presidential commission, I never returned to NASA. I was not welcome back at NASA, but Fortunately, I was given a job by the U.S. Treasury Department, and I spent the next 20 years there. The White House did try to get me fired from the Treasury Department, but thank goodness there were career workers at Treasury who said, no, we're not going to get rid of this guy. He's a good analyst. And so I made the rest of my career at Treasury, but I also had a chance to study the U.S. financial system, where I learned so much that after I retired, I guess I kind of blew the whistle on that too. So I guess that's just
Well, it's interesting because you predicted this explosion, as it were, and you're kind of predicting another explosion, metaphorically speaking, of the U.S. financial system if we don't heed your warning. So what's the story there?
Well, I began to study the entire history of the U.S. financial system, going back to the very early days of America. And a lot of this study is in my book, Our Country Then and Now, because even though it's a general history of the country, it focuses on government policy with respect to finance. And then we saw in the United States, starting in the mid-1800s, a gradual takeover of the United States by the international banking system. And that has really been going on ever since the Civil War period. Now we're coming up on 200 years. And the international financial system is essentially run out of Great Britain. And it was the British who came in when the Federal Reserve System was created in 1913 and created a duplicate, essentially, of the Bank of England, which gave immense financial powers to the private financial system to use certain mechanisms, such as what we call fractional reserve banking, and essentially a system of usury or high interest rates, to gradually have the effect of sucking all the wealth of an economy into the hands of the bankers. And that system has been going ever since. Of course, there have been hiccups. One of these hiccups was the Great Depression. One of them was the 1979 to 81 big recession that brought Reagan into power. It was engineered by the Federal Reserve. The one we're most familiar with is the one of 2008-2009 called the Great Recession, which was another collapse of the banking system because of the inherent contradictions where you have a banking system that simply sucks up all the available money in an economy, uses that to gamble with, to create derivatives and leverage buyouts and all kinds of other abuses. And then that system collapses. And we had that collapse in 2008-2009.
And when they win, they win. And when they lose, the taxpayer is on the hook, right? So they're actually, the banking system are in a no-lose situation because they don't actually, because the money has to keep on flowing or whatever. I remember the Great Recession of 2008, and it was very much that we can't afford not to bail out these guys. So it's a huge, because of our economies will collapse. I don't know if that's true, or that was a self-serving claim, but it means that there's a huge moral hazard there because they can continue to gamble with our money. And if they win, they win. And if they lose, we bail them out.
Well, here's a number for you. It's in my book, but very few people really were aware of it or understood what it meant. How much money did the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve have to put up to bail out the banking system in 2008-2009? $16 trillion is the amount that had to be put into the system. Now, excuse me, a lot of that was loans, but it wasn't all loans. The Federal Reserve also created their own account where, for instance, they purchased and became owners of the largest insurance company in America, AIG. Now, you might ask, well, okay, they bailed the system out. How did they assure that it wouldn't happen again? Particularly because the federal government deficit keeps climbing and is now over $34 trillion. Where did that come from? Well, very few people realize that it came from the Federal Reserve buying the U.S. Treasury debt that was needed to float that gigantic deficit. And you see things like, well, okay, we need $61 billion more to bail out Ukraine. Well, where's that coming from? It's coming from the same source. It's coming, and this is what critics mean when they speak of money printing. It's an account created by the Federal Reserve to essentially give the federal government any amount of money that it wants for whatever purpose it wants. And that has created this tremendous debt overhang now that is called the Federal Reserve portfolio.
And I guess, I mean, I've been following, it's a hugely important topic. I've been following Michael Hudson's discussions on various, I don't know if you're talking about the same thing, because I'm trying to piece together, I talked to all these highly intelligent experts, whether you, sometimes you're in at opposite camps, or whether you're all agreeing with each other, but in different ways, and you're talking about slightly different things. Because my very simplistic understanding, I'm quite critical of what the British are up to, I think. But I think that, I guess the sort of the global South narrative is something like this. The Americans can print as much money as they want and pay for everything, you know, just like a private printing machine, as long as the dollar is used for the to buy oil with. So you can have as many dollars as you want floating around the world, as long as the dollar is an accepted currency. And then when you have small countries that want to create their own currencies or challenging that, you know, you slam them against the wall. So, you know, they don't get any ideas of going their own way, you know, and of course, starting to pay for rubles with rubles and rupees or yuan for oil threatens that, you know. So it's a delicate situation for the US, because if people stop wanting to use dollars, you're in hock for this amount of, you can't just print money anymore. Is that that really simplistic version? Is that accord with what you're essentially saying?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Michael, I know Michael, he was one of my mentors back when I was learning all of this stuff. Yeah, he's absolutely right. And that system came into play with the petrodollar back in the 1970s when Nixon took the United States government off of the international gold standard. Henry Kissinger made a deal with the banks of Saudi, the oil producers of Saudi Arabia and other oil producing companies, that if you came back and deposited your oil revenues in our banks, we would allow you to raise the price of oil by a factor of 3 to 4. And that was the oil price shocks of the 1970s, which became the excuse that the Federal Reserve came up with for crashing the U.S. economy in 1979 and starting to shift so much of America's manufacturing plant resources to Mexico, to China, to other low-wage countries. So, yeah, it all comes together. But what you so have it, is,
I mean, some of the – I've also talked to a couple of guests, American usually, who sort of talk about this, the British Empire never went away sort of thing. And some people think, you know, that the campaign against Trump after 2016 was partly run from London, you know, the MI6 and so on. And the British media now in January talked about Trump as being they were pretty naked. I mean, they didn't say, well, Trump's orange man, he's a fascist or whatever. Says he is a threat to British interests, we can't have him, you know. That was a cry of desperation from the British intelligence community through their assets and journalism, you know. And so Trump's onshoring, bringing back manufacturing, is he a threat to this globalist British interests?
I gave this a good bit of thought preparing for this program, because one of the things I was told we were going to talk about was the election of 2024. So this fits right in with that. If you go back and you study American history carefully, there are essentially two basic opposing factions. One of them is represented by the Democratic Party, and one of them is represented by the Republican Party. The basic tenor of the Democratic Party is what they call internationalism. And that's where the United States is going to play a very active role, essentially in taking over and ruling the world in league with British interests, because that's been the whole tenor of the British Empire, as we know, going back deeply into the 19th century, but certainly coming out into the era of the world wars. And so, yeah, the Democratic Party has been very closely allied with British interests, with the interests of international finance, and they still are. And that is really the backbone of the current Biden administration, the internationalist perspective. On the other hand, the Republican Party has traditionally been what they have called isolationist or nationalistic. And you can take this again all the way back into the creation of the Republican Party in the mid-1800s during the Civil War era, and follow that gradually all the way through modern history. It didn't always determine exactly the alignment, but that was the general tenor. What people often don't realize is that when Trump came along, regardless of what Trump's background was, he and the people advising him were able to tap into this traditional Republican attitude of America first. And because the American industry was essentially given away by the internationalists, the lead one being Bill Clinton, when Trump came along, he tapped into the nationalistic perspective.
Richard, we've got to go into break there, or we've got to end this for our next show. Thank you very much. I'd love to have you on again to talk about your latest book, Our Country Then and Now. Richard Cook, top whistleblower and top analyst on financial and political issues. Love to have you on again. This is the Pell and Aaron Taylor Show.